This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
It is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Hi, good morning. You're listening to Indie Media on RTRFM with Alex and Zoe. And I want to acknowledge that we are lucky enough to be presenting in Boorloo on Whadjuk Noongarrbuddja and understand that it always was, always will be. What do you have for us this morning, Alex?
Well, first of all, I want to applaud Jeff, as always, as part of our weekly tradition, and make particular mention of that wonderful editorial tirade right at the end there about the lovely Gina Rinehart. And I like the Streisand effect, which I was trying to remember the exact reference there, because I think that was where she sued somebody for a story that, and in doing so then drew the world's attention to that story. So hence known as the Streisand effect, where somebody tries to bury something through legal action.
I believe it was her address.
Attention to it. Was it her address?
I believe she shared her address. Oh, okay. It was to do with Google Maps or something like that.
Okay. But no, so it is hilarious, this Gina Rinehart thing. And for people who don't know, Namajira the artist, he's done two dozen other portraits. So, and they're all done in that sort of style. No one else has complained. No one else has complained other than Gina Rinehart, and frankly, I think it's a pretty flattering portrait. But there you go. Poor old Gina. Poor old Gina. One does feel for her and her many, many billions of unearned dollars in her bank account.
The amount of people who would have printed that photo just to keep it as a memoir.
Absolutely. No. So hopefully, it gets exhibited in galleries all around the world in the coming years. That painting.
Yeah. So this week on Indie Media, I am covering something about the encampment in Amsterdam. So now 2 weeks ago, the student encampment was dismantled by bulldozers that had students on them as officers in riot gear deployed with pepper spray, struck protesters on the head and legs with batons, and they also began dragging the students out by their legs. This has been one of the most extreme reactions we've had by police against an activist encampment worldwide at the moment. And the confrontation underscored mounting tensions as European campuses, after weeks of unrest at the US encampments, all rallying for a ceasefire in Gaza. In retaliations, protesters atop makeshift barriers with bricks and wooden pallets then used fire extinguishers to push back police, but then were later charged and arrested. So I spoke to Faye Jordan, who is an Australian activist currently living in Amsterdam and was involved in the encampment, and will unpack what went there.
And people who have been following the news of the student encampments in Australia will know that university administrations by and large have taken a different approach, not leaning heavily towards a police crackdown. Having said that, there was news this morning that notifications went up, or signage went up at on the grounds of Melbourne University campus, referring to trespass, and that the encampment is now illegally there. The Monash University has bundled up their encampment under threat of legal action. So slowly but surely, and there was actually an emergency meeting of some of the leading Australian vice-chancellors regarding how to deal with these encampments. So slowly but surely, it seems that those administrations are moving towards the police shutting them down. But also today on the show, listeners may have seen the very troubling news last week of the jailing for 5 years and 8 months of David McBride. David McBride was a legal officer for the Australian Army. He served two tours of duty in Afghanistan, and he revealed evidence after there were multiple internal approaches to the Australian Defence Force of evidence of war crimes by the SAS in Afghanistan. All of those submissions to the ADF were summarily ignored. And so Mr. McBride felt it was his legal duty and his moral duty to reveal that evidence to the public, and it was subsequently the subject of investigative stories by the ABC and a Four Corners report. Lots of sort of moving parts to this story, but the long and the short of it is that none of the soldiers alleged to have committed war crimes in Afghanistan have been jailed, but Mr. McBride, who drew attention to those crimes, has been jailed by the ACT Supreme Court last week. So to discuss that case and the implications for whistleblowers and military justice in this country, we're going to be joined a little later on by Rowana Ruff, Executive Director of the Australian Centre for International Justice.
Heavy, heavy stuff. You're listening to Indie Media, which is a grassroots activist program on RTRFM 92.1.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
You're listening to Indie Media on RTRFM. And as Alex and I spoke about a little bit earlier in the show, I spoke to Faye Jordan, who is an activist currently living in Amsterdam, and we had a chat about how the protesters at the encampment at the University of Amsterdam were ambushed, and students and protesters were beaten and arrested by the riot police. There also was footage of police dogs attacking officers due to the aggression they were showing, as those dogs are signaled to attack aggression, but they ended up attacking the officers themselves. So Faye was there and has been there for days, but we had a chat just after they were arrested. I started by asking Faye about how the camps were set up, like at the beginning, the overall energy prior to the arrival of the police.
I got there in the late evening, and so I don't really know what it was like before then, but by that time it was pretty chill in that, like, there was people who were asleep in their tents, and so there was people who were, like, reading, and there was snacking, you know, smoking cigarettes, chatting with our friends. Like, it was really quite chill. There was tension in the sense we were aware that the police had been called on us, because we were people who were in contact with the university. But other than that, it was very calm. The way it was set up, it was like a pretty small area, and there was four entrance points, and they were all barricaded. Very makeshift, but quite sturdy.
Were those barricades put there by the students who built the camp, or were they put there by the university staff?
Both, because both the university staff and the students were a part of the encampment. I mean, we've seen what has been happening at the encampments around the world, so it was a pretty obvious measure to protect us. And they're very makeshift, very, you know, sort of just put whatever you can on it. But we built them up pretty tall. Then inside, I mean, you had like all these little one-person tents, and then you also had some bigger tents. There was a tent that was used for food and water. We also had like a medic tent, and there was allocated spaces for like toilets. So this area was surrounded by canal, and then on one of the sides there was this support demo happening that was like a little bit what we would call like low risk in terms of arrest, because it wasn't in the encampment. And so there was a lot of people there by the evening. There was people playing drums, like chanting, that kind of stuff. By that time, until the police actually like raided, it was just sort of a waiting game of, are they gonna come, are they not gonna come? But yeah, other than that, it was, you know, quite calm.
So there were reports that there was violence erupting that night. It said it was Monday, so there would have been the night of your arrival, saying that there were counter protesters that came with flares. So what happened here? And do you think it was the catalyst, or perhaps maybe just a pretext for the university, who admitted to then calling the police to try and shut down that demonstration?
What's interesting is that I know of a counter-protest that happened, but that happened well in the morning, quite early in the morning, counter-protest. I mean, we were calling them Zionists. And they came in, I think about 10 of them. They had like fireworks or flares or whatever they are. And they just like started punching people. There was always police set up outside the encampments, not the riot police, just like the regular police. And I know for a fact that that is not what was the catalyst, because the police didn't do anything about the counter-protests. The protesters were the ones who had to drive them out of the encampment. Again, that happened way earlier in the day.
Turning to Tuesday, when the police did finally arrive to break up the encampment, can you explain what had really happened on the ground? Because even as you've just mentioned, the reports that are coming out about what happened differ greatly to that recount.
Yeah, I mean, so we were seeing police were starting to mobilize. There was a lot of vehicles outside. From about 12 till about 2:30, they were mobilizing. I think around 2:30 was when they came in and they broke up the support demo that was happening outside the encampment, which I didn't specifically see. But when I looked back, there was just the street that people had been protesting on. There was just lines of vans. And then there was the riot police and they had their dogs. And so they were basically chasing people out. And I think some arrests were made as well. They would sort of, one of their strategies was to single people out to be able to arrest them. And then after they had broken up that demo, they were mobilizing outside most of the barricades. And so I was at the barricade, the first barricade that was bulldozed, which I think was around maybe 3 a.m., 3:30, I'm not sure. There was a lot sort of happening at the other barricades as well. But for us, our barricade was also the one that was like sort of the quiet for the longest time. And then the bulldozer came and you could just see behind the bulldozer was just lines and lines and lines of riot police. And so they attempted to bulldoze. I mean, there was people standing on the barricades as well because on lookout, the bulldozer went ahead, no matter if there was people on the barricade or not, broke it down. We rushed to try to remake it as best as we could. It came, broke it down again. And then at some point, one of the other barricades got compromised. And so then we had police coming from basically two sides, or maybe three sides. And there was just screaming and a lot of chaos, because if they singled you out, they would just beat you. So like you kind of tried to get together as a clump. That was like our main strategy. So then at some point we were just surrounded. We were in this tight clump. There was police on the in the boats and the canals and just riot police all around us. Then we sort of had to make a choice of, do we try to resist arrest or do we not? Because I mean, we've seen what they've been doing to the protesters around us. Like they could just beat us. So we cooperated and we walked down the street that was where my barricade was. They were very aggressive. They would shove us. We were in a very tight crowd. So there was a lot of points where it's like, if someone trips, like they're done for. And there was bikes around us as well. So it was very stressful trying to, because there was points where the people in front of you like weren't moving, but the police were still pushing you forward. And then at some point, I guess they announced the group of us, which probably would have been around 125 to 150 people, that we were under arrest. And they had these buses, which were the GVB, which are the like public transport of Amsterdam, buses lined up. And they basically just herded us into buses. There was people who initially, I think, tried to not get pulled away from the crowd. But again, they would just get beaten. So at some point, we just followed onto the buses. And then we were driven to about like quite West Amsterdam. And they just made us wait in the buses for hours. Because at this point, it was now, I think we got arrested around 4:30, quarter to five. And we were in the buses past seven, like 7:30 or something. Because between like 12 a.m. and 9 a.m., like they technically can just keep you and that doesn't count towards how long they've detained you. And then very slowly we were processed, so they ID'd us and then they let us go. They charged us. I don't know if we got fined. We got charged with trespassing. So we might be the people who got arrested. We might be receiving like a fine in the mail or something. But obviously everyone's going to dispute it. But it was obviously to mainly move us from the encampment.
The people who were being attacked by the police, other than from what you've explained, trying to escape, were they doing anything that could, for argument's sake, be seen as antagonizing the police? Or was it literally if they tried to remove themselves from that situation or stand their ground, they were the ones then being beaten?
It was mostly if you were standing your ground. There was people who they tried to like sit down to hold their ground and the police are just beating their legs because they want to break up the crowd. So at that point, I mean, it's not like there were people who threw bricks at like the bulldozer and stuff like that, but ultimately it didn't matter if we were violent or not because they set the tone of how far they can escalate.
To your knowledge, were many people actually hurt or hospitalized?
I mean, lots of people were definitely came out with bruises. If you're hit on the head with a baton, easily can cause a concussion. I heard of some more severe cases. I heard of a girl who bleeding and passed out on the floor, and the police just checked her pulse and then chucked her into a police van. Actually, yeah, so on that night, specifically on like the Tuesday morning, I remember when people were rushing sort of to the crowd that I was in, that like they pepper sprayed people. So there was a girl who got pepper sprayed. There was someone who was hopping on one leg, so clearly ankle was not good. And I mean, also definitely further injuries at other protests as well.
As to the encampment now, or after it was torn apart by the police, has there been pushback from the demonstrators? And after the arrests, was there still that morale to go back to the encampment and enable it to continue?
Absolutely. I mean, they re-liberated the encampment from the police the next morning. It was probably the people who weren't arrested. But that was actually, it was obviously like a fear tactic to, because this was the first day of the encampment and we haven't seen this kind of escalation on the first day. But it very much backfired because there was even more people the next day. They managed to drive out some of the police vans, like push out the police vans. And they set up a second encampment at one of the other unis, the UVA's locations closer to the center. And yeah, the protests only kept growing.
Here, I guess there isn't as much of a pushback from the police as long as these encampments are being kept safe and palatable. And the only real police action has more so been on the demonstrations, like with Unionists for Palestine, where they're actually obstructing work from them. In Amsterdam, what is going on, like, with the police and activism around pro-Palestinian effort? What is actually happening there that would validate why the police acted so intensely on the first night of a student and activist encampment?
I can theorize. I really don't know. I mean, partly it is the response that we've gotten is also is partly fault of like the higher ups in the universities, because they are the ones who are, you know, have called the police on us, on their own staff and their own students. And I think because maybe the encampments really forced them to pay attention in a way that maybe demonstrating down the street hasn't. Because I was in Europe in October and I attended several of the rallies, and most of them were pretty fine.
Police involvement by fine, is that what you
mean? Yeah. So like I hadn't really heard of a lot of arrests. There wasn't like riot police, really. They were able to go on quite peacefully. Maybe they really don't want to let go of these ties to Israel that they have. Maybe it's giving them a lot of money, you know?
It's quite alarming.
It's very alarming.
That was Faye Jordan having a chat about the protest at protest encampment at the University of Amsterdam after the dean of the university contacted authorities to come and remove protesters. But they did go back the next day, as well as other rallies going on in Amsterdam, however, with continued excessive police force.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
Alex, what do you have?
So, as we talked about at the top of the show, many listeners would be aware, or hopefully are aware, that there is a sustained, I would say systematic, assault on the rights of whistleblowers right across the Western world, and Australia is no exception. Obviously, the headline case is Julian Assange, who is facing extradition to the United States and a possible life sentence there for the crime of espionage and information theft. He may be extradited even within the next few weeks. But in Australia's court system, in the ACT Supreme Court specifically, another whistleblower, Australian military former military lawyer David McBride, was sentenced to nearly 6 years in jail, and his crime was revealing evidence of war crimes. And no soldier's been jailed for these crimes, but hey, the whistleblower's been jailed, so we can all rest easy at the integrity and state of our wonderful, wonderful justice system. To discuss the implications of this grotesque absurdity and act of injustice by the ACT Supreme Court, I was joined a little earlier today by the Executive Director of the Australian Centre for International Justice, Rowan Aruff. And we began our conversation by asking Rowan more generally about the work of her organisation and the role that it plays.
Thank you so much, Alex, for having me. We are a somewhat new legal centre. We're 5 years old, which is striking for me because I founded the centre many years ago, seeing a real gap in the services available to victim survivors of international crimes. We're an independent, not-for-profit legal centre, and our main, our primary role is encouraging Australian authorities to investigate and prosecute international crimes, which many people might not know are actually criminalised in our criminal code, and we have the jurisdiction to investigate and prosecute people, wherever they may be, that have been involved in the perpetration of these crimes. We also work on targeted sanctions, human rights sanctions referrals to the Australian government. We work on strategic legal action and advocacy. Our areas are quite diverse. We work on Palestine, on Sri Lanka, on India, on Ukraine and Russia, on Myanmar. We do a lot of things. You know, it is very exciting work that we do, but very important work, as you suggest. And it's a real pleasure and an honour to be working in this space and working with the communities and the partner organisations in Australia and around the world.
Now, we've got you on the show today in relation to what many would argue is a case of injustice, in fact, and I'm referring to the sentencing last week in the ACT Supreme Court of Australian former military legal officer David McBride to 5 years and 8 months in prison with a non-parole period of 2 years and 3 months. His crime, passing on to journalists evidence of war crimes, or at least prima facie evidence of war crimes by the SAS in Afghanistan. Your immediate reaction to the sentencing of David McBride, Rowan?
Yeah, when the news came through, you know, although it was somewhat to be expected, I think we were all still very shocked and saddened to think that McBride wouldn't be going home to his family and support dog that night, and that he instead would be spending that night in prison. And he has been now in prison for more than a week for doing something courageous in the public interest. And I think, you know, the prosecution and imprisonment of McBride sends absolutely the wrong message that the Australian government is not serious about the need to address and reckon with the legacy of its military involvement in Afghanistan. It sends an absolutely, you know, devastating signal that Australia is not taking its international law obligations to investigate and prosecute international crimes seriously. It shows others that if you speak up about injustice, that you'll be punished, that you'll be reprimanded rather than being acknowledged, appreciated and honoured. And I think globally it also sends a message that Australia is not taking accountability seriously or respects people who speak up when there is wrongdoing. So ultimately it undermines Australia's commitment to truth and transparency and accountability and justice.
Now, one of the most egregious aspects, it seems to me, of the McBride case is the fact there has been no convincing argument made, no persuasive information proffered by either the Australian military or the Australian government, let alone any court of law, discrediting the evidence McBride revealed. In fact, the opposite is true. In 2020, the Inspector General of the Australian Defence Force Afghanistan Inquiry Report, better known as the Brereton Report, found there was, quote, credible information supporting the claim of deliberate unlawful killings by multiple SAS soldiers in Afghanistan. And famously, or if you prefer, infamously, Ben Robert Smith, a highly decorated soldier and recipient of the Medal for Gallantry and the Victoria Cross, lost his defamation case in the federal court, the court effectively finding he was responsible for the murder of three men while on deployment in Afghanistan. It's a very heavy question, of course, Rowan, but why then, in your opinion, is it McBride, of all people, a whistleblower, the man who let the world know of these crimes, being sent to jail?
Well, I think that's the question that we all should be answering and the government should be answering, really. I think the time and resources that were invested in prosecuting McBride really stands in contrast to the immense effort that we think is needed to investigate and prosecute the alleged perpetrators themselves. And then ensuring that those investigations also examine any potential criminal liability all the way up the chain of command, as you know, that's a very important issue that we'll be monitoring. I think it's also particularly outrageous that the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecution continued its prosecution of McBride, given, as we heard last year, if you remember, following the outcome of the Ben Robert Smith defamation trial, the Australian Federal Police had mishandled the investigation into at least three incidents that he was involved in, including, it seems, the killing of the farmer Ali Jan at Darwan, and that brief that the AFP provided to the Commonwealth prosecutors apparently sat around the office for 2 years. So it showed a stark contrast that the CDPP and the government really, they were all systems go on prosecuting McBride and sending him to jail. I guess the perception, the appearance of it is that, they were all systems go on McBride, and we still, the justice process is still lagging somewhat. It allocated, like I said, a large amount of resources into prosecuting this man, but not addressing the serious gaps in the justice responses. And when I talk about serious gaps, our organisation 2 years ago released a report that monitored the progress and the updates on the responses of the Australian government to the recommendations of the Brayton report. And we did say that they are lacking. For example, one of the issues that my organisation is following is the recommendation to provide prompt payments of compensation to victims and their families, irrespective of the findings of guilt. That's what the recommendation was, because it was the correct and right thing to do. But over 3 years, and we're still yet to see any plan from the government, and no family in Afghanistan has seen any form of compensation, let alone a plan or a commitment to other forms of redress and other ways to repair the harm that was caused onto the families and the communities in Afghanistan, particularly in Uruzgan province. So, the government should be really focusing on addressing the legacy of its military involvement rather than going after whistleblowers.
There are echoes here clearly of the Julian Assange case and indeed other current trials, and many would argue state-driven persecutions of whistleblowers, specifically with respect to Assange's ordeal, which is ongoing. He's facing, as we know, extradition to the United States, perhaps even within the next few weeks. One of the parallels is, frankly, the way much of the media seems to have abandoned its support or indeed gratitude towards McBride for elevating their own careers. The ABC was itself embroiled in this whole rotten saga when its Sydney offices were, in an extraordinary development in 2019, raided by the Australian Federal Police, searching for the very evidence that McBride had provided them as the basis for what later became award-winning investigative journalism. Now, I don't mean, of course, to disparage any individual journalists who I think in some cases did heroic work, but it does seem that one could argue, turned their back on McBride, given all of the legal troubles he's subsequently faced. So how do you assess generally the role of the media, and not just the McBride case, but also more broadly in exposing Australian war crimes in Afghanistan?
I wouldn't disagree with anything that you've said there, but I just want to start off by saying, in fairness, I think we do have to credit the role of public interest journalism.
Certainly.
Who pushed to get the stories out into the public. They, of course, didn't do this alone. It was thanks to people like Mike Bride and others, including within the Special Forces, who spoke up. And we all know about the culture of silence. Speaking up is a courageous and admirable act. And the Brayton Report, in fact, talked about this culture of silence in its report, and found that the whistleblower protections were not adequate for soldiers to raise concerns about unlawful actions, which is why some people went to the media, obviously. I mean, this is where we're finding ourselves today. I do agree with you. I think the ABC was unfair and incorrect to raise questions about McBride's intentions in the way that they have. It doesn't suggest that it shouldn't be up for discussion, but I do think it wasn't a good faith attempt. The timing, I think, was terrible. I'm talking about the Four Corners piece that was out a few months ago. It was before the sentence hearing. And I think it ignores that people have multiple motivations to bringing wrongdoing to light. And McBride does describe it in full. I don't have all of the details with me now, but I do think it was unfair in the way that all of that came to light. So I do think they should be doing a much better job. I do think there's been a bit of a stalling in terms of stories in relation to Afghanistan, but I could tell you about some of the work that we're doing about trying to get just actually interest in the fact that Australian dual nationals are fighting in the Israeli military currently. There are at least, according to some estimates, 1,000 that could be involved in the Israeli military now, and they're exposing themselves of being involved in the perpetration of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocidal acts. We wrote to the Attorney General last year and the Home Affairs Department to raise concerns about this issue because there was a lot of media stories that were somewhat favourable and positive about these people going back to Israel, these citizens, the Australian citizens, going back to Israel and fighting in the Israeli military. You know, they were positive stories, which I found, you know, really remarkable and outrageous because of the very serious crimes that the Israeli military is credibly accused of, and the fact that these people, you know, could be coming back to Australia having just committed these crimes. So we called on the Australian government to monitor such individuals and to investigate them. Because of the likelihood that they could be involved in international crimes. And we haven't had any interest from the Australian media so far in covering these stories from that perspective, from that very real perspective. So, yeah, I do think the mainstream media needs to do much more in investigating these issues.
We may well get you on another time, Rowan, regarding that very important subject you've just raised of potentially Australian citizens involved in war crimes in Gaza right now. But just finally, the Brereton inquiry found there was potential evidence of 19 soldiers having murdered. It's important for our listeners to understand that the scale of crimes involved here that ought to be investigated but aren't really being investigated sufficiently. 19 soldiers having murdered or at least unlawfully killed 39 Afghan men. And yet to date, only one soldier has been arrested and charged with murder. That soldier will be facing trial later this year. Given this state of affairs, Rowan, and given not one single Australian soldier has thus far been convicted of any war crimes, despite compelling evidence such crimes did indeed take place, how confident are you we will ever see justice served?
I think it's important to be critical of the justice process. Certainly we are. It's a long and laborious process, but I do think we should give the Office of the Special Investigator an opportunity to do its work. It's going through a lot of material. We do think that they are serious and competent and up to the task, but definitely we will be monitoring a few things on the progress of the investigations and the prosecutions in the years to come. As I mentioned to you, one is looking at how far investigations will look at the chain of command, but also how much the Office of the Special Investigator is serious about involving victims as much as possible in the process. And so I think, you know, that's very important. We should, you know, also give credit to Australia's approach more broadly. Yes, there are very serious criticisms, which we've discussed already in this discussion. You know, Australia is the only country of the allied countries that has taken up this process to the extent that it has so far. You know, no other country has investigated and opened these types of investigations, these serious investigations, in the way that Australia has. You know, to put it in context, Alex, Afghanistan is a country that's suffered through 40 years of war. There's been conflict after conflict. The cycles of impunity compound. And so there's no measure of justice or accountability for the countless victims there. And we know that victims and their families spoke up and continue to speak up at the time of the alleged unlawful conduct. there are reported incidents of families turning up, making complaints and allegations about the unlawful killings and the torture and the wrongdoing to various people, the province administrators, to the Afghan government, the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, even to the ADF headquarters and to the media, but they were completely ignored. The Britain Inquiry even acknowledged this, and there's an element of racialization and racism in the way that they were ignored, that the allegations were seen as exaggerated and that complaints were said to be made so that people could seek the benefit of compensation. So it's despite the persistence of Afghans making complaint, just to bring it back to, you know, our subject of discussion and seeking accountability for the injustices, that nothing would have eventuated if it wasn't for people like McBride and brave people within the special forces who continue to push and try and blow the whistle and try and bring those allegations to the public sphere and begin that process of reckoning with the misconduct, the unlawful conduct which amount to war crimes.
Rowana Ruff, the Executive Director of the Australian Centre for International Justice, speaking to me earlier this morning about the case of David McBride, which as Rowan said, is going to have, I think, pretty potentially long-term implications for not only military justice, but whistleblowing generally in this country.
Alex, you have a little bit of news?
Yeah, a little bit of time to discuss absolutely extraordinary development in Iran. Still breaking news, but according to the latest reports, the Iranian Red Crescent Society has found the site of an alleged helicopter crash in the northwest of the country in East Azerbaijan province near the border with Azerbaijan. It was reported overnight, Perth time, that a helicopter carrying Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, as well as the Foreign Minister Hassan Amal Abdullahian, had crashed in that northwestern province of Iran, reportedly in a very dense fog, heavy rain. So certainly the preliminary evidence would suggest that it was a crash. Obviously, that's not outlandish. It's entirely plausible, entirely possible that it was a crash. But obviously, part of the reason I'm bringing it up on the show, and I'm sure if you've not seen this news already this morning, as a well-informed listener, you would be having the first thought that I had when I saw the news, which is quite obviously the distinct possibility that this is an assassination by the Israeli army. Now, I'm not saying that that is the case. I'm not even speculating that that is the case, but clearly that it is a possibility. It is sort of a story that that it is very much a breaking story, and regardless of the exact cause here, it's sort of part of this whole febrile atmosphere throughout the Middle East. We know, by the way, just in defence of, you know, that possibility of this being an assassination by Israel, you need to understand the historical context, that there's nothing remotely far-fetched about that possibility, given that there is a long, long history, a shadow war, in fact, between Iran and Israel, with Israel having murdered dozens of Iranian scientists and officials and military officers using drones, using secret agents, using car bombs. So there's been that shadow war in which dozens of Iranians have been killed. And, of course, most recently we saw the Iranian consulate in Damascus attacked by Israeli forces, senior generals being killed. So we shall see what the outcome is. I mean, just briefly on Ebrahim Raisi, he was elected president in 2021 and was reported by many commentators as a potential heir to become the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is 85 years old, and some commentators, as I say, have suggested Raisi was the next in line. So it's obviously, you know, extremely important figure, the second most powerful figure. Certainly since the assassination of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Special Forces Commander Soleimani a couple of years ago, one of the more powerful figures in Iran. So we'll await further news with this, but I'm sure the Israelis will be pleased with this news in terms of, you know, destabilising potentially the regime in Tehran. And meanwhile, in Gaza, of course, the offensive in Rafah continues. And the Biden's very, very brief pause of the supply of military weapons, in particular 2,000-pound bombs to the Israeli armed forces. It was just a blip. The resumption of military supplies to carry out mass murder has continued. So, you know, there's sort of two ways of looking at it. One is that it was just a little PR stunt, sort of a prop to people concerned about the murder of children, that he temporarily paused those weapon shipments. The other aspect of it potentially is that Biden is really concerned about the electoral impact of what's happening in Gaza, particularly in places like Michigan, which is a swing state, and Trump is well ahead in the polls in Michigan, which for those who don't know, has a very large Arab and Muslim population. A lot of, just as an aside, a lot of our Arab workers actually brought in by Henry Ford to work in the auto plants there in Detroit. So that's the historical reason why there's a large Arab population in Michigan. But so there's electoral aspects. There is, I think, also the strategic element that I think Biden, well, not Biden himself. We know he's obviously a senile man and sort of a figurehead at this point. But the military and policy advisors around Biden, concerned not for the lives of Palestinian people, but concerned about destabilisation of the region, and that this is a military gambit too far by Netanyahu to invade Rafah, given that Hamas militants and other militants are dug in. And of course, we've heard all this propaganda around tunnel networks. The fact is there are large and extensive and sophisticated tunnel networks throughout the Gaza Strip. And even a lot of Israeli officials now are admitting that actually 7 months in to this offensive, They haven't wiped out Hamas, not even close, and that Hamas retains its command and control structures and its ability to hit Israeli forces. There were I think it was 6 Israeli soldiers killed in one incident just last week in the north of Gaza, and that's significant as well. Palestinian resistance forces remain active, you know, in the north of Gaza, which had allegedly been cleared of militants by the Israeli army. So, anyway, lots happening in the region. And we'll wait and see, you know, exactly what the true nature is of this this extraordinary development. Hasn't yet been confirmed that they've been killed, but Iranian Red Crescent Society saying no signs of survivors at the site of a helicopter crash in the East Azerbaijan province of northwest Iran, in which it would appear that Iran's president and foreign minister have been killed.
That's it for us at Indy Media. Been a good show, Alex.
It's been a pleasure. Yes, yeah. Indeed.
We've got through that. Any bullying?
That's true. And no sort of teasing. No.
There's back compliments
and, you know,
all
lots
around.
Compliments. Just lots of positive energy.
If you're not a stalker of Alex Wissen, is quite the AFL footballer these days.
Oh,
so
well,
we had a little bit of a chat about that. thanks for hanging out with us.
Indeed, it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and as we say every week,
don't hate the media.
Become the media. Bye.
See you next week.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.